Hi, I'm Lisa Davis. Welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM. I'm honored today to be joined by Rabbi Kushner to talk about his latest book, Conquering Fear, Living Boldly in an Uncertain World. Harold Kushner is a rabbi laureate of Temple Israel in the Boston suburb of Natick, Massachusetts, after serving that congregation for 24 years. He is best known as the author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People, an international bestseller, first published in 1981, that has been translated into 14 languages and is widely considered one of the most influential and important books of popular theology. Rabbi Kushner, welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM.
Well, thank you much, Lisa. It's a pleasure to be talking to you.
Yes, I'm so excited to have you on the program. In the beginning of your book, Conquering Fear, Living Boldly in an Uncertain World, you have a section called First Words, and in that you write that this is your 12th book, and this is the first one where your editor came to you with the idea. Now, how did that feel for you?
I was very grateful. He came to me and said, would you consider writing a book about how people are afraid of so many things today? And I said, you're absolutely right. I'd noticed it, but I hadn't really picked it up as an idea for a book. And it's the sort of book I would like to write. There's so much in the Bible about God giving people the courage to deal with their fears. I vaguely remembered reading somewhere, I would speak of it as trivia, except nothing about the Bible is trivial, that the words God most often speaks in the Bible are, don't be afraid, usually translated, fear not. I went and checked that, and something like 85 times.
Wow.
In the Hebrew Bible alone, and I don't know how many times in the New Testament, God has occasion to say to somebody, don't be afraid. And so I realized this is a major theme of what people are coping with and a major subject of what religion and the kind of spiritual approach I like to share with people can be helpful to them.
Yeah, and, you know, speaking of sharing with people, one of the many things I love about the book is that you write that you wanted to share some of your fears. You write, quote, before I could write a book about what people today are afraid of and how they might deal with their fears, I had to first write about what frightens me. Can you share a few of those things with us?
I think a lot of what scares people is a sense of something important in their lives being out of control.
Mm-hmm.
What scares me is not that something bad might happen to me. I'm 75 years old and I've had a very satisfying life, but that something might happen to people in my family, people I care about, and that there'd be nothing I could do to help them. I worry about the direction our country is going in. There is so much free-floating anger out there. People are just so, they're not angry about specific things. They're sort of angry in general, looking for a target to dump it on, and that makes me very uncomfortable. I'm angry about the rapid rate of change, which leaves a lot of people of my generation feeling like immigrants in their own country. This must be what my grandparents went through when they came here from Eastern Europe, and they didn't speak the language, and they didn't know how things worked, and they had to depend on their children to explain things for them. And every time I have to ask my grandson to help me straighten out my computer, I feel like I'm an immigrant again.
There are
a lot of things which bother me at that level.
Yeah, I'm bothered by the way society is going, and it seems like our current society is really exacerbating our fears. And I know that you touched on that in the book.
Yeah,
if you can talk a little bit.
Somebody found out, and it isn't recent, this is probably 75 years ago, somebody found out that you can make a lot of money by scaring people. You could attract a lot of votes by scaring people. And I'm sorry that, you know, I wish God hadn't made us in such a way that we're so easily panicked. The idea that I think my theory is it started with the people who invented a disease called halitosis, bad breath, or something to cure it. And all of a sudden you were afraid that your breath offended people. You're afraid that there was something wrong with the way you were coming across to people, with your appearance, with your complexion. And whatever it was, worry about it, and we have a product that'll fix it for you. And then, of course, the political agents came in, and you notice how many political ads have nothing to do with extolling the virtues of one candidate. They're designed to scare you about what'll happen if his opponent gets elected, and I just think that's a cheap shot.
Yes, it is. It really is, and you see that so much. And you ask a great question in the book, how do we learn to overcome fear and live bravely in an admittedly dangerous world?
Sometimes I have to deal with somebody who comes to me for counseling with an irrational fear. They're afraid of flying, although I can tell them statistically, you know, Going on an airplane trip, the most dangerous part of the trip is probably driving to Logan Airport.
Yeah.
Statistically, you're much more likely to get an automobile accident, but when you're in a plane, it's out of your control. So if you're really, if you know that and you're still afraid, if you know that the odds of being hit by lightning are minuscule, but you're still afraid, if there are all sorts of things that frighten you, heights, being out in crowds, I usually suspect that's a cover for something else you're afraid of and you just don't want to face up to, and that probably at that point you could probably benefit from some professional help.
You share a story of a woman in your congregation who was terrified every time she went shopping with her young children.
Yeah,
and when you really talk with her, you saw there was something deeper emotionally going on.
Yeah, I explained to her, you know, she'd read a story and she'd read a novel about kids being kidnapped in a department store, and she was afraid to take her young children grocery shopping with her. And I said, you know, that's irrational. And she says to me, I know it is, but it's still frightening. So I recommend she talk to a therapist, took two sessions to find out what was going on. She wasn't really terrified of a kidnapping. She was afraid every time her mother told her she was being a bad mother, every time her mother criticized her for the way she was raising her daughter, she felt inadequate. And she was afraid something would happen to the daughter and the mother would come along and say, see, I told you you weren't fit to take care of that child. And once she realized that the problem was not criminals lurking in department stores, the problem was a hypercritical mother, that what she had to learn to do was try and understand what's driving her mother and put those views in perspective and not let it get to her, then it became a lot more manageable.
Mm-hmm.
Another fascinating case of a woman who was afraid to fly, and the course of her business and the course of her vacations with her husband, it terrified her to get on airplanes. And then her husband, he was a doctor, and he was murdered by a patient. And she told me after that she was no longer afraid to fly. She had this attitude of, we've had our tragedy, and the next time it'll be somebody else's turn, so nothing bad will happen to me again. And again, it's irrational, but this whole business very often is irrational.
Yes. Yeah, I would actually think the opposite. I lost my mother when I was in my 20s, and then 6 months later I lost my grandfather, and I kept thinking, okay, something, it's just going to keep going. Like, all these bad things are just, like, when's it going to stop? Like, things would be good, and I'd be kind of looking over my shoulder, saying, okay, who's going next? And it took me a while to realize that that's not a way to live your life, obviously. So it's interesting how people have different reactions to things like that.
It's utterly understandable. Some of your listeners, if they are of a certain vintage, will remember the comic strip Little Abner, which there was a character who walked around with a black cloud over him, and bad things happened to him wherever he went. And I've known people like that, either because their constitutions were frail, they were more prone to sickness, or they were socially inadequate and they kept alienating people. Yeah, there are people who seem to attract bad luck and bad health. But for the most part, it's fairly randomly distributed, and practically nobody gets through life without it.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. You write that all of our fears are variations of one basic fear. What is that?
I think at the root of a lot of it is the sense of being out of control, level of anger in society. An interviewer asked me, where is this anger is coming from? And I had an insight, I think this is true, that anger very often is a man's way of dealing with fear, that it's considered unmanly for a man to admit that he's afraid. And so he manifests it as being anger. He transmutes the fear into anger, but underneath the anger is fear. And underneath the fear is a sense of things being out of control. If a person can't make his or her marriage work out the way they want, if a person is concerned about losing his or her job, and by the way, Lisa, the one thing that surprised me most when I was researching and writing Conquering Fear was that there is something scarier than the fear of illness, serious illness, and imminent death, and that is the fear of rejection.
Mm-hmm.
I would not have predicted that. It never would have occurred to me, but the single most devastating prospect that anybody looks at is the fear that either they will lose their job or somebody important in their lives will reject them. This message that from somebody whose opinion matters to you, you have nothing to offer me, you are of no value, that is the ultimate devastation. Lisa, I've had women in the congregation who handled the diagnosis of breast cancer better than they handled the news that their husband was leaving them for another woman. Because breast cancer, they could work with the doctors to do something about. But that sense of ultimate rejection from somebody close to them, it made them feel worthless. And the cure for it, I found out, was don't try to think it through alone. Surround yourself with people who cherish you. And when society or somebody in society reflects back to you the message, I don't need you, find people who will say to you, we do need you. We know what is special about you, and we care about you very much.
Well, that is so beautiful, and that makes so much sense. I mean, I think something that's missing in our culture right now is that sense of community, and everybody's on their, you know, everybody thinks, well, I'm connected, I'm Twittering, I'm on my BlackBerry, I'm on email, or, you know, but there's something about really being with people and getting that love and support.
Technology simply does not do it.
No.
Computer's a wonderful thing, but it can't love you back. Your message, the text message, it's nice to be in touch, but that's not... Literally, that is not being in touch. I had this idea recently, I may work it into a sermon sometime, that one of the reasons for the increased divorce rate and the higher level of marital unhappiness is mm-hmm. we are asking too much of our immediate families, our spouses, our children. We want them to provide all of the emotional nourishment that we used to get from a community, from friends, from coworkers, from colleagues, from people you would meet for a drink after work, for women in a book reading group. We are so totally reliant on our nuclear family, and we're asking too much of them, and when they can't give us what we need, we're disappointed in them, and sometimes we're just angry, and sometimes we look elsewhere.
What tips do you have for people about, you know, building community?
First thing I would recommend, and I'm not doing this because I used to be in the profession, this weekend, find your way to your church or synagogue. They exist for community. I was once at an interfaith conference where I was seated on a panel next to a very articulate Christian ethicist by the name of Stanley Hauerwas. And we got to talking about this, and he said something to me I've never forgotten. He said to me, individualism is the Protestant heresy. I asked him, what do you mean by that? He said, we made a terrible mistake by defining religion as a one-on-one relationship with God. It's not. It's about people binding themselves to each other to invoke the presence of God. Sociologists have found that the earliest, most primitive forms of religious life are not to connect people to God, but to connect people to each other. When there is a death, a loss in a family, when there's a wedding, something to celebrate, when there's a famine, when there's something going on, people don't want to be alone. Why were the churches so filled the weekend after 9/11, as they were on the weekend after November 22, 1963, when Kennedy was shot?
Mm-hmm.
Because at a time like that, you don't want to be alone. The first place I would look for companionship is in the church or synagogue. The second place I would look for it is in the workplace. I have a neighbor in Natick who, he's retired now, he used to run a business of novelties. You know, these ballpoint pens with your company's logo printed on it, he would arrange to manufacture and sell them. He had a small office in a small office building. And one day he calculated that he didn't really need the office. He could work out of, you know, by phone. They didn't have computers in those days. He could work from home. So he gave up the lease on the office, started to work out of his house. 2 weeks later, he was back in the office. The work was going fine. He missed the camaraderie, familiar faces in the hallway, bumping into people in the coffee shop, just having people around to chat with. Human beings are not meant to live in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many decades ago, when I was an undergraduate student at a course in anthropology, of which I remember one sentence and I've forgotten everything else, a writer on chimpanzees said, one chimpanzee can't be a chimpanzee. He needs a tribe.
Oh.
And I think in the same way, one human being can't be a human being. You cannot be a total human being in isolation. You need to connect with other people. And if it's not through marriage, if it's not through parenthood, it should be through friendships, through church circles, through work, through volunteer organizations, rotary clubs, book reading groups, something. We are not meant to be human in isolation.
Yeah, you know, and this actually really relates because you talk about in the book that, you know, part of overcoming fear is living your life to the fullest, and that you're going to have a much richer life if you have friends and family that you love and good work and feeling part of the community.
Yeah, they give you the opportunity to express things which are latent in your soul, and they will be there for you when you need them. Like the time that I was really at a low point in my professional life, and a colleague who'd been through something similar invited my wife and me out for dinner and bought a second and third bottle of wine and swapped stories with us. And it was exactly what we needed, the sense that somebody cared about us.
Yeah, that really does help. You know, in the book, you write something that I found so interesting, and I think, you know, I've seen this in some of your other books. You write, quote, God is moral, nature is not.
The quote really came, it occurred to me in the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake in San Francisco, which is a memorable experience. Boy, you go through that,
yes,
and don't forget it. But I used that when I was invited to New Orleans on the first anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. I spoke to a congregation, an interfaith congregation, in the largest house of worship that was still left standing. And I said to them, you're here to ask me where was God and how could God let that happen. I can give you the answer in six words. God is loving. Nature is blind. The hurricane was not an act of God, whatever the insurance companies call it. And don't listen to those preachers who say, well, this was the punishment on San Francisco, the gays, the hippies. And
that is so terrible.
Centrist New Orleans lifestyle. No. Hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes, all the terrible things that happen and continue to happen and happened in Haiti and happened in Oklahoma and happened in Tennessee, they are nature. And nature is blind. It is just following its own laws. A falling rock or a speeding bullet have no way of knowing who gets in its way and whether that person deserves to be injured or not. It's simply nature. Where is God? I said to the people in New Orleans that anniversary, God was with you when you went out in your rowboats to rescue your neighbors from their rooftops. And God inspired tens of thousands of college students to give up their spring break and come mop the streets of New Orleans instead of partying on a beach in Fort Lauderdale. God is not in the tragedy. God is in the human response to the tragedy.
You are just so wonderful. It's so beautiful. I mean, I love what you have to say. I love your work. And I want to encourage everyone to get Conquering Fear, Living Boldly in an Uncertain World. And how can people learn more about you?
Why do they want to learn more about me?
Fabulous.
You're sweet, Lisa. I could talk to you all morning. I don't have a website. I don't think I'm important.
Oh, okay.
Website.
Well, they should just go out and get your books.
I want people to know about my ideas.
Yes.
My books, all dozen of them are still in print. They can be ordered from a full-service bookstore or online from Amazon. And all they read to know, a lot of them are personal. My first book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, was prompted by the death of our 14-year-old son from a very rare disease, progeria, the rapid aging system.
My most recent
book that you and I have been talking about has a lot of stories about my personal encounters, including the time I was invited to go to Germany to talk about bad things happening to good people, maybe, I don't know how many years after, 35 years after the Holocaust or so.
Oh, wow.
I put a lot of myself in the books, but mostly it's my ideas, and people ought to be interested not in my life but in my ideas.
Yeah, well, your ideas are fabulous. And, you know, I wanted to mention your free lecture and book signing. It's going to be Sunday, May 16th at 10:15 a.m. It's Conquering Fear, Living Boldly in an Uncertain World. And it's part of the Arts at Trinity series, and they offer lectures with nationally renowned authors. And it's at Trinity Church in Copley Square in Boston. Again, Sunday, May 16th, 10:15 a.m. I'm going to be at my cousin's daughter's bat mitzvah in Chicago. Otherwise, I would love to be there.
I'm sure
it's going to be a wonderful event.
I have to tell you, Lisa, being invited as a conservative rabbi to speak at Trinity Church is quite a trip for me.
You are so delightful. And if people want to reach me, they can go to itsyourhealthradio.org. I hope everyone has a terrific week. If you can, please go and see Rabbi Kushner. He is, like I just said, delightful. Everyone have a great week. Keep being healthy. Bye-bye.